Hi everyone, and thanks for joining us for another episode of LID Radio Podcast. I'm your host for today, Francesca Stainer, and for this episode, we hear from Dan White about his book, The Soft Skills Book, The Key Difference Between Becoming Highly Effective and Valued. Dan White is a marketing and insights innovator. His frameworks and visualizations have influenced generations of marketers via the methodologies they have informed, including the world's leading brand measurement, media evaluation, and copy testing systems. This unique blend of expertise ensures that every piece of advice offered in the Smart Marketing book and the Soft Skills book is based on robust evidence and wealth of practical experience. In this practical and savvy book, Dan White describes the soft skills that anyone in today's world of work needs to learn, absorb, and demonstrate if they are to progress in their career. Uniquely illustrated and presented, the author explains each soft skill clearly, why it is relevant and important, and how to apply the skill to your working life. In short, the book provides the missing link to ensuring your job and career is successful and fulfilling. I mean, I guess every role, sort of, no matter what your position is, will involve a certain things. So projects being one of them. They might be different magnitudes, different lengths of time, but project management is something that's rarely taught, I suppose, and it's assumed that everyone can do it. And sort of alongside that, I guess many articles and books on change and change management cite how often projects can fail. What are these kind of, and you mentioned it in the book, there are seven things to consider when starting a project in order to make sure it's successful.
Yeah, I've got a framework of sort of seven sort of steps stroke considerations. Yeah, you know, I think you're right. I mean, obviously, unless your job is actually labelled as a project manager, where you do get training almost always, or you've specialised in that area. But actually, a lot of working life people are running projects. I mean, projects kind of just means, doesn't it, working on the current thing that you need to do. Yep. And are trying to run these projects without the training. And I think that's true of a lot of these areas. It's like there is specialist training involved, available, but training budgets these days don't seem to extend to that. You know, I think I was very lucky back in the sort of 90s and 2000s, where there seemed to be a bit more money going around for training. So I got sent on all sorts of things, and that's where I built up my notes, by the way. But in terms of project planning, I think if you just follow these seven steps, you should be fine. The first one is, even for a project, you need to be clear on the purpose and a bit of a vision for what the project is meant to achieve. So people use the phrase, you know, what does success look like? Which I think is a nice way of thinking about it. You know, at the end of this project, what are our outputs? What will we have achieved? And what will it feel like? And just spending just a little time defining that and talking about that with the team can really help throughout the rest of the project, particularly because it allows people to use a bit of their own initiative. You know, if they know what the vision is, that they'll be able to make their own decisions and make good decisions throughout. So again, it's that context piece we talked about earlier. So that's step one, purpose and vision. Then at the early stages of figuring out what this project is going to be all about, it's helpful to brainstorm the tasks. So number two is tasks. In other words, think of all the things that will need to have happened, need to have been done in order for the end results to happen. And sometimes it's quite often working backwards. You know, what the outcome is, you say, well, in order to get that outcome, we will need to have done that, achieved high level this and this. Well, how will we do that? Well, we'll have to do this and this first. But anyway, the principle is you brainstorm all and you don't yet plan. You're not trying to figure out what you're going to do when or even who's going to do what. Not yet. The first stage is just what needs to have happened, needs to be done. What are all the tasks? And you just list them out in random order to start with. And once you've got them in the random order, then you can start to group them and put them in sequence. But it's that first step of just brainstorming them all can be incredibly helpful. Don't try and rush to the nitty-gritty plan before you've thought it through. So that's kind of number two. Then the third one is just capturing that, really. Number three is action plan. So capturing what the tasks are, who's going to do them, and when they're going to do them, roughly, broadly. Then number four is resources. Obviously, in order to achieve all those tasks, you will require certain access to certain resources, and there'll be costs, almost certainly. There'll be costs associated with it. Make sure you're clear on what they are up front and that you've got them. And if you haven't got them, obviously, you need to try and obtain them in some way, or increase budget or whatever. That's four. Number five is schedule, and this is more the detailed schedule. Mm-hmm. And this is like exact dates, effectively, but not just exact dates. Also, the detail of, certain tasks can be done in parallel with others. Certain tasks can only be done after something else has already been achieved. So that's the principle of those. And there are things like Gantt charts that you can use to help you capture this and think, make them clear and easy to refer to and communicate, stuff like that. And then you've got six is monitor. So yeah, even at the beginning, at the beginning of the project, before you start, when you're planning and setting it all up, it's important to figure out how, for example, all the different parties, when and how will they keep in touch with each other? How will we review progress? Quite often you go to your schedule and go, are we on schedule and, or not, and make adjustments. How will you flag issues? How do we escalate or flag issues? What's the process for that? And if there are any conflicts, how will those be resolved? So everyone's clear in advance. As soon as anything goes slightly wrong, everyone knows what to do. So that's six. And then the final one is good practice for whenever any teams that are likely to do similar task in the future, which is review. In other words, getting together after the project's been completed, just to identify, it can be quite simple and quick, but just to identify what went well, and what you would do different, three things. What went well, what you would do differently next time, and how should we communicate these learnings? In what format, to whom? If you do those things just after every project, then your team and the parties you deal with will just get better and better if it's a similar task in future. So it's worth the extra half an hour or so to just step back and learn.
Yes, definitely. Otherwise, you won't improve in the future.
Exactly.
Sure. I mean, we've touched on it quite broadly, but talking a bit about delegation, which is obviously a huge part of a managerial's role, many have, I guess, issues with relinquishing that control, and sort of you see it written about quite a lot. So why do you think delegating is so important, and what benefits can it have for the manager and the team?
I think delegating is important in the sense that a lot of companies rely on having a relatively small number of experienced and expensive people and a larger number of less experienced and less expensive people to do more of the work, because that's how you keep costs down and that's how you provide good value, for example, to a client. So it's kind of a business model that's fundamental, really, because of costs, really. So it is important that delegation happens and it happens effectively. I mean, I'm sure a lot of us have been in scenarios where you see people, directors of a company, senior people within the company doing very day-to-day things that their junior people should be doing because they're not, like you said, they fear losing control or don't think the job will be done well enough. But then that becomes a very inefficient company. There are things you can do. Obviously, in researching the whole book, I looked for if there were existing frameworks. In this area, there was nothing I could find that was... there were lots of thoughts on it, but no kind of handy framework. So I've come up with... I've called it the delegation pouch. Okay. And it's the idea is the pouch is like, kind of a pouch of gold from sort of medieval times or whenever. I've got a story that goes with this, which I won't attempt to replay to you now, but it's the idea if you've got something important, like you need a bag of gold to be taken to a debtor somewhere else, you need to make sure that you delegate in an effective way, and I use it as an analogy. But the pouch is also an acronym for how to do it well, how to delegate well. And it goes like this. So P is for preparation. So preparation is two things. Firstly, deciding who is the right person to delegate to. May be obvious, may not be obvious. You know, are do you believe they have the sufficient capabilities to do what you need to do? And then what also preparation is, what else, what information and resources will they need to do it well? So if you think of those things up front, you're already off to a really good start in terms of delegating well. So that's before you even approach the person to brief them.
Sure.
And then the second one, which I guess is where a lot of managers get things slightly wrong. You know, some managers will then tell the person what needs to be done and exactly how to do it. And that is not good delegation. It's very demotivating. And also, if they don't really understand what they're doing that well, they can often get it wrong. And they feel they can't go back to you because you told them exactly what to do. No, the best thing to do at this point is to describe the outcome. That's the O of pouch. What is the outcome we're trying to achieve here? Not exactly how you should do it. That's quite an important distinction. Then the third thing would be clarifying that the person has understood what's required. So often a simple technique here is just to ask the person, once you've briefed them and you've told them the outcome and what resources they've got, to ask them to play back to you how they see the task is. And then, of course, you can fill in any misunderstandings, correct any misunderstandings and fill in any gaps. And then the C is about commitment. So once you've got to that stage, they clearly understand what needs to be done, you ask how committed they are to getting the task done within the time frame. And you can even use a scale of 1 to 10, you know, how confident are you that are committed to this actually happening? And if they say anything lower than about a 9, you go, okay, great. What would make it a 10? And they go, well, I don't know, because this could happen. So, okay, well, how can we make sure that doesn't happen? So you keep going until any barrier or potential barrier that the person can see, you've thought of a way around it, until they basically, yeah, okay, I'm happy now. Once that happens, the chances of them actually doing it skyrocket to almost 100%. And then the final one is H, and this is important, again, for managers who have a tendency to interfere or to be overprotective. H is just stands for help. So you, as a good, if you delegate well, you should be available and the person should know you're available to help and support and answer any queries, but only if the person asks for it. You shouldn't interfere beyond anything you've already agreed to do at the start. So that is absolutely foolproof, I promise. And I've noticed even some very experienced people have said, oh, I've always not really cracked delegation, but they found this extremely, extremely handy.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think a lot of the experiences I've had and a lot of people I know have had is sort of delegation tends to just be, here's something I need, and it's just in an email and there's sort of no discussion at all about it. Exactly. And it can often be, every delegation seems to be urgent as well. And I think having that conversation, I think, would make it a lot easier to get both people on board and get.
I'm a believer that you can only delegate by talking.
Yeah.
It has to be some form of conversation, and ideally not a sort of series of emails going back and forth with questions. No, I mean, a live conversation. No question about it, because then you can do the pouch. I would do that even if it's a fairly small request, unless it's just something that you've done a million times before. You know, it's not really delegation, it's just a sort of, it's just asking for something that's been done before. But Jen, if there's any ambiguity about it, conversation, yeah.
I guess sort of moving on to another topic you cover, which I think everyone will be interested in, is multitasking. We kind of know as the world now that multitasking is ultimately a myth. Like, no one can do it well. There's I think a tiny percentage that actually can, but we all try and do it anyway. And especially where sort of teams have been reduced in COVID, sort of a record number picking up additional responsibilities in their original job roles and descriptions.
Right.
I mean, time management is still a key skill everyone needs in a workplace, personally and professionally, really.
So no, you're right. Yeah, everyone's busy, right?
Exactly. So what are your sort of top tips for time management?
Yeah, I think there are whole books about this. So, I like to provide a bit of an overview of some of the most important principles. And there are there are four main principles that's helpful. I mean, one is planning, of course. You know, in order to use your time efficiently, you need to do some sort of planning of what you're going to do when. You know, to-do lists are one thing, but actually when you're going to do what different things is also important. A good tip is when you're planning, to plan like your week ahead, say, in just broad brushstrokes. In other words, the main thing you're going to do on Monday morning and Monday afternoon, and then what are you going to do on Tuesday morning, etc. That's the bigger tasks. And then each day, plan ahead the next day in more granularity. So that, because there's no point in planning, you know, in detail for a whole week because things change. You sometimes get ahead of yourself if you're lucky. Often you might get behind yourself, and you will have to reprioritize, obviously, quite regularly. But it's worth doing it for the day ahead, so you know what you're going to do. The other thing, of course, is try to find times when, for example, if you've got a complex task, something you're going to really need to concentrate on, it's best to do that when you're at your best. So if you're an early morning person, schedule it for the morning. If you're you know, somebody who likes to work in the evening, that's fine. Just schedule that task for an evening if you so wish. And also, if it's complex, and you know, make sure it'll be a time you won't be disturbed. So just being mindful of what you're going to do when, so that you can make best use of your time. So that's kind of the first of the four, planning. Oh, the next one is setting time limits. Yeah. You know that phrase, what's the phrase? You know, work expands to fill the time.
Yes.
Completely true. It's absolutely true. You know, if you say this task is going to take this whole day, it will probably take all day. If you say it's going to take half a day, you're more likely to actually get it done. And there's strong evidence that is actually the case. So always set a time scale. You know, okay, if you need longer, then you need longer. But give yourself that little bit of challenge, and you'll actually find you can get it done. So that's the other thing. Always set some time limits. And also, I'll get in the book, also go into more detail about the idea of prioritization. You know, I might as well mention it now, but the key principle is, you know, the amount of time you allocate for something should reflect how important that thing is.
Mm.
Yeah. When you do it, should reflect how urgent it is. Do you see what I mean? And you sort of think of those two dimensions can help you maximize best use of time.
Definitely.
So that's number two, wasn't it? Oh yeah, number three is, it goes back to your point about multitasking and kind of why multitasking is a bad idea. I mean, think about multitasking, when you flick basically from one thing to another, etc., is that it does take a little bit of a while for the brain to remember what it was doing, you know, to reorientate and to refocus on whatever those different tasks require. So by flicking around between them, you're being less efficient. And this is particularly important for a kind of repetitive tasks. You know, if you do it in one go, you get faster and faster and faster. I mean, I can think of a really, really boring example, but I had to do it the other day, which was to transfer some numbers, cut and paste, put them in Excel, you know, move. And it was basically the same thing for quite a lot of many times. But I got, you naturally get faster and faster and faster because you remember the sequence. And it's, your motor skills get better. And so the third principle is working in batches. Yeah, do things in batches. And that the biggest benefit, if you're in a company or work with people who use email a lot, and that's true for a lot of us, do not just keep flicking at looking at email every sort of few minutes or so. Set maybe two or three times a day where you spend quite a long time, but you actually process them all. That can be much more efficient than jumping around. That's number three. And then the fourth one, it depends on whether you've got a team to swap with, but the concept that if you work as a team, you may be able to swap tasks with a teammate, if it's allowable, if it's appropriate. In other words, you know, something you enjoy doing and you can do really fast, you can take that off from someone else in return for them doing something that you find quite time consuming. And a lot of that's actually to do with being in the right role, of course, but sometimes there's an opportunity to maximize efficiency that way.
Mm, like working to your strengths.
Well, exactly. I mean, I could give an example. I will actually. My wife is a primary school teacher.
Okay.
And she loves teaching things like music in particular. Whereas she absolutely hates teaching sort of sports. Yeah. She just doesn't know enough and hasn't really developed that. So she will often swap with a colleague who loves doing sports and doesn't know much about music. So both of their preparation time goes down and their enjoyment and reward goes up because they spend more time doing what they're good at and can do really, really well quickly. So that's a live example. You probably dropping my voice a little there because she's in the other room. She might to share that insight. But there you go.
An exclusive on the podcast.
Exactly. Right? Let's hope she doesn't listen to this particular one. Yeah. Well, yeah, so those are the main tips, I think, for time management.
Brilliant. Thanks to Dan for joining us, and thank everyone for listening as well. Now don't forget to keep an eye on our social media at Lid Publishing on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram, and at Lid Business Media on LinkedIn. We'll be sharing more podcasts, articles and books from thought leaders such as Dan White. Take care and see you next time on Lid Radio Podcast.